Hello to all Earth citizens and welcome to my Conscious Coaching Podcast. This is Dr. Kianush, founder and creative director of MCCG. My Conscious Coaching Group is a non-political, non-religious 501c3 coaching nonprofit with initiatives in healthcare, leadership, and education with focus on emotional and spiritual intelligence. Our vision is to raise self and global awareness for a conscious mind through education and application of EQ and SQU. And our mission is to connect, collaborate, and partner with hospitals, academics, colleges, and medical schools and organizations to embrace growth, self-healing, and self-coaching to achieve well-being and peak performance of individuals and the team as a one connected whole. Today, our guest speaker is my lovely Iranian-American friend, Dr. Susan Abadian, the author of Generative Cultural Renewal, which offers ethical and culturally sensitive means of evolving traditional cultural practices. I met Susan in one of GMU educational conferences about Iran's recent evolution to revolution, and she brought up the topic of collective population trauma and role of culture and spirituality, which made me interested. As you know, cultural intelligence and spirituality is one of the focus and tier of MCCG coaching model as well. Dr. Susan earned a PhD in political economy, government, and also a master in anthropology of social change and development, both from Harvard University. She also has an MPA in international development from Harvard Kennedy School. Her research on healing the effects of long-standing collective trauma and cultural damage in indigenous communities was described in economics as pioneering and original. She teaches and speaks internationally on leadership, personal and cultural renewal, healing, intergenerational collective trauma, and integration of indigenous knowledge and wisdom. Her portfolio included preventing violent extremism, rights of religious minorities in Middle East and South Asia, gender-based violence, and cultural restoration following atrocities. She also has served as a fellow at MIT Dalai Lama Center for Ethics and Transformative Values, as well as at Harvard Centers for Public Leadership. Susan, welcome to our podcast and such an impressive educational journey. Can you please let us know what you like the world to know about you, except what I mentioned?
Well, thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, Kianush John. And I want to just honor you as I've listened to your introduction about what you're engaged in, just how remarkable it is that you are presenting such an integrated approach and really just honor what you're doing as well. So thank you. Thank you for doing it for all of us. I think the one thing that you didn't mention on my resume that I think is probably the most valuable thing for me is that I'm newly a grandmother. My son had a son anyway. It's just the most incredible experience to see your own child have a child. So anyway, I'm having another wonderful experience learning from my grandson, the delights of being alive on planet Earth. So it's just so remarkable. Anyway, so that's the one thing I'd like to share with the community.
So wonderful to hear that, and congratulations on the new and the new life and the new life and light in your family. So
thank you. As they say in Iran, I look forward to the day that you have that experience as well.
Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah.
So Susan, yes. Just my yes. First question. We just go directly to the question.
Please.
Yeah, I want to ask you about, as a trained anthropologist and a political economist, how did you become interested overall in trauma, especially the ancestral trauma? And what do you mean in general by collective trauma?
Well, thank you for the question. I didn't start off interested in trauma per se. My background was in international development. My father was an economist in the World Bank, so I grew up in the field of international development, poverty alleviation. And working with communities that are disadvantaged around the world. And so most of my work originally, what I was trained in, was poverty alleviation. When I had my young kids of my own, I didn't want to be traveling overseas anymore, didn't want to be working in overseas communities. I wanted to do something closer to home. So I looked at issues of poverty in the US and Canada and got interested in Native American communities, First Nations communities. Also, I want to give back something to the communities who were, in my view, hosting us here in this beautiful land and allowing us to be here on their, you know, ancestral land. So I wanted, if I could, to give something back. And so I went into the First Nations tribal communities and really want to ask the question, why were some of these communities languishing the way they were? Why are they struggling with poverty at rates that Bangladesh was struggling at the time in the most wealthy of nations in the US and Canada? Why were there such pockets of poverty? So when I went into these communities and talked to people, I remember the first time I went to the communities, it was the summer, and I spent weeks interviewing, talking to people, and the stuff that came, that, you know, and I asked questions, but they would answer me kind of for me in a mysterious way, because they would talk about the experiences that their families have had, their relatives in boarding schools, residential boarding school, Indian boarding schools, and the suffering, what now I understand is trauma, and how that's still affecting them. Because the questions I ask is why the poverty? Why were they still struggling with poverty? And most of the times they talked about historical things. And oftentimes the traumas, now that I have language for it, the trauma. So over time, I developed the language for what I was hearing. And it had to do with not just individual trauma, but collective trauma and collective trauma that had happened, including traumas that had happened over 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 400 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it really became apparent to me that these things were still affecting peoples and communities. So that's how I developed an interest in trauma. And I wrote a doctorate. The man that you mentioned was Amartya Sen, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Mm-hmm. And he was one of my doctoral advisors. And he's the one who quoted, you know, the work as being pioneering and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, there's a Harvard Magazine article from 2008, I believe, that describes my work in tribal communities. And anyway, I learned a lot from these communities. I mean, I don't know what I contributed to them, but they sure contributed to me. And I learned a lot about what holds back communities, why communities sometimes are stuck in cycles of poverty and violence, and the role of trauma in that whole cycle. Part of what I discovered in my work is there are many different kinds of collective traumas, and they have different kinds of effects on communities. Some, you know, we can have collective traumas like a hurricane that devastates a community, or, you know, some kind of natural disaster that's almost like a one-time experience and then it's done. And that's a very different kind of collective trauma than, say, a trauma that's been occurring over, you know, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years. And then, so there's a time factor, traumas that are collective. That means that they affect large groups of people or larger groups of people than one. But also, the other difference between collective traumas besides time is, you know, who they've affected. So traumas that have affected, important, you know, institutions in the community, and also traumas that have affected culture over time. So for example, in the case of Indigenous peoples, Native American communities, and also First Nations communities, the whole policy, residential boarding school policies, for example, were designed to really destroy the family system on some level. And also the original spiritual traditions of the people, these were institutions that basically tried to Christianize these Native communities. And by doing so, they also damaged the communities quite a bit. So they affected culture. They damaged culture. And so cultural damage, in my mind, is some of the worst kinds of traumas that you could do, collective traumas that you could, impact communities with. And also just want to say that, you know, one of the questions that I give talks on is this question of, well, people, I used to be asked this question, and I started giving the talk about this question, which was, why does collective trauma matter? Because you have, you know, you've had after World War II, you had the Germans, the Japanese, the Jewish community. They've undergone huge and horrific, the Jewish community in particular, horrific kinds of collective traumas. So and they've obviously recovered, you know, in the minds of many people, they've recovered. So these communities have recovered. So why does it matter? Why can't other peoples, like Native peoples, recover? And I have a whole talk about why these traumas are different. And why in some cases of traumas, it's much harder to recover than others, and what that mechanism is. So I can't go into it right now, but it's a big conversation, basically, that I've, I've been in the habit of giving.
Yeah, to touch up, on what you mentioned, talking about the different kind of trauma and the collective trauma, I remember that during my internship, it was the Iran-Iraq war, and that was a kind of collective trauma for me. And as you mentioned, as a consequence of collective trauma, we can carry those trauma in ourselves and in our genes and pass it to the next generations. And talking also about the chronic trauma, what do you think about the COVID and what we went through, for a couple of years in past few years during the COVID? Do you think that, especially after the COVID time, it seems that this has become a household word? And why do you think this has some dangers associated with it?
Oh, well, I mean, COVID's an interesting situation in that the whole world went through it at once. But imagine, I mean, this was just a couple years that we went through this. But imagine, so this is an example, like imagine what indigenous peoples went through. Like many indications that 60 to 90% of indigenous peoples were affected by the diseases that Europeans brought to this continent. Really, our collective trauma is fairly minuscule. And imagine if 60, 90% of our people were killed off, what that would do to us. So just that gives you, so yes, it was a big, big trauma, big collective trauma. And yet, in the scheme of things, compared to what First Nations, Indigenous peoples have been through, it was really nothing. So I just want to put that in perspective. But generally speaking, trauma is important to, I think it's an important thing to be aware of. I speak of the danger of trauma and resistance to, I mean, I have a whole, again, another whole paper that I've written about resistance to trauma and dangers to the trauma framework of adopting the trauma framework. The danger, in my view, is the only danger that I see. I mean, it's important to understand trauma, the effects of trauma, obviously, and to surface whatever those effects are so that we can clear them. The danger is that sometimes trauma becomes identified with, meaning that people start to identify themselves with their traumatic event. I'm a traumatized person, or people label other people can be, the danger is in being labeled a traumatized person, and it becomes a source of identity and harder. I mean, my whole work is about freeing ourselves from the effects of trauma or any kind of limitation. Trauma is just one kind of limitation, but any kind of limitation. So if people get stuck in the label and being labeled that, that's what I think that's a dangerous thing. Does that make sense? I hope I'm making myself clear.
Yeah, it does. It really does. And I like the work that you have about the healing. It's mostly focused on the healing, the trauma, because personally, I also believe in the post-traumatic growth as well. So to me, I mean, as Rumi says, I mean, the wound is the place that the light enters you. So it's just that trauma, as bad as it is, to me, can be a tool of transformation, to a healing and growing journey as well.
Whenever we're dealing, I know you know this as well, but whenever we're dealing with people who've had trauma, I don't start off with that understanding, because it seems insensitive. You don't say, oh, well, this is a opportunity for you to grow. No,
yeah, definitely.
Obviously,
yeah.
We wish that you didn't have this experience. We wish this never would have happened. Eventually, at some point, they themselves realize it's not for us to say to them that it can be an opportunity for them to grow.
Exactly. That definitely, I mean, acknowledging, and validating the emotions, that it comes with trauma, it's vital and necessary. But as you mentioned, there are different stages and steps, but eventually, the trauma can become and transform to a growth at some point. My question was, Susan, do you believe in mysticism?
Well, we jumped to that, didn't we? Do I believe in mysticism? I consider myself a mystic. So yes, I very much believe in mysticism. Whatever the belief is, I consider myself one.
Yeah, because I remember that you and I were talking, and you had a childhood, near-death experience story as well. And we discovered it through our conversation when I sent you my chapter book and I'm telling you my story. And you wrote back to me that, Kianush, you helped me to bring out my childhood ND story out of the closet finally. And can you just tell us a little bit about that, your childhood story and ND story? And that's why I ask you about the mysticism and if you believe in it as a part of, healing trauma tools,
Well, it's so interesting. I think I might have mentioned to you also that I'm not in the habit of mixing these topics. So it's really wonderful to have an opportunity. You know, I either have a spiritual conversation or I either have a kind of academic conversation. So to be having both in one sitting is a little bit different for me. So there's a story in my mother and my grandmother used to tell me when I was younger that I almost died five times before the age of five. Now, I don't remember those experiences except for one. And in one of the experiences, and I've never really, I never really spent a lot of time thinking about it until, you know, I started meditating in my 30s and 40s. I think at one point I had a lot of memories that came up when I finally quieted myself down and like looked into it and I saw what had happened. And basically, you know, as you know, in Iran, most of the properties are surrounded by metal gates and mm-hmm. metal walls. And mm-hmm. so in this situation, I was a year and a half to 2 years old, and a metal gate had been unhinged and was leaning against the wall. I think it was a 6-7 foot gate. You know, they surrounded, you know, this was the entrance to the house area. And I pushed it probably, I don't know what happened, but it fell over on top of me. And I had a 14-year-old babysitter whose foot got caught underneath, a leg got caught underneath it. And apparently the doctor said, and I had a severe concussion. If I lived through the night, I would live. But in the meanwhile, what happened when I remember what I can see is that I came out of my body. And basically I have an image of viewing myself from above. And I had these, I was trying to leave. I had these, what I considered to be guardian energies. There were two of them who wouldn't let me go. And basically I was pleading with them. I want to go. This is much more than I anticipated. It's not what I bargained for. It's much harder than I thought. I can't do this. And they wouldn't let me leave. They said, no, you've got lots more to do. You got to go back. And I just, it was this kind of tantrum. I was having a tantrum basically. and then kind of like this elastic energy that was brought me back. And it wasn't any kind of cord or anything, but just that it was sort of this tension that mm-hmm. sucked me back in. And I just remember feeling this claustrophobia. And then from then on, I think that I was really changed. It was almost like a division that was no longer there. Mm-hmm. And I was able to see things and feel things and had, you know, just kind of an overwhelming experience of what it was to be on Earth. I mean, probably I was pretty sensitive anyway, maybe why I couldn't handle being on Earth in the first place, but, you know, on empathy overload. And mm-hmm. It just got worse, I think, and did more difficult and very confusing for me as a child. I was very confused about, and it didn't leave immediately, but confused about what it was, you know, what the rules were here on Earth. And also people were confusing to me. So I could feel, and this is still an issue for me. I can feel kind of their higher self, their soul self, and fall in love with that person. And then who they show up as a human being is very different sometimes. And so that's confusing to me, who they could be and who they are mm-hmm. in fact living. And so I've been, you know, I'm sort of shocked by the maliciousness sometimes, or some of the more negative behaviors are really hard for me. The harshness, the cruelty, you know, various, the meanness, you know, micro meannesses that, you know, and I it just kind of always surprises me. I've not always been good at knowing how to handle my own feelings of anger, or, you know, kind of my own more so-called negative feelings. I've had to really learn, because I've judged myself. I'm my worst judge of myself, because it's not who I am. So it's was always really hard for me to handle those things. And I almost, you know, I used to tend to run from them rather than deal with them, with my anger, for example. And so I've gotten better as I've gotten older, but it was very confusing for me to be here. And also just, I think I had psychic abilities I didn't know what to do with. I could see things. I actually could see through, you know, people would say things and I could feel who they were, what they were really feeling. And it was always confusing, the deception. I mean, all sorts of things. So it was very confusing as a child growing up.
Completely with you. I mean, on that page, you know, and NDEers, as much as it seems that it's an enlightening, you know, experience, but it most of the time it comes with a trauma. You know, for example, for you, you know, falling metal doors on you. For me, I mean, having a after a surgery, some happens, you know, after a car accident. So they most of them are related to the trauma. So it is important to know the emotion. Emotions, you know, and the after effects also of the NDEs and how we should deal with it, especially if when it happens, you know, in childhood and with the children. Knowing that, what do you think that, I mean, a psychiatrist or a parent or our teachers should know or educate, be educated about the children with NDE or mystical thinking?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for asking that question. I haven't thought a lot about it, but I know that in my case, and I could just the little that I've begun reading. I mean, I'm fairly new to this world, to tell you the truth. But what I wish people had understood, I must have been confusing. I was not only confused, but I must have been confusing for the adults around me and the children, because I was told I had a vivid imagination, and it was kind of, I was shamed for it. So what they thought was imagination were things I was probably seeing. I was actually, I think I mentioned to you, as a child, I had a nickname. My mother used to call me, my grandmother used to call me, who loved me. I mean, they loved me, but they used to call me Chakan, which in Persian is a diminutive kind of a thing you say to a child, like a fibber. She's a fibber. I used to lie, they would say. And I never understood that because I'm one of the most transparent people you could ever meet. I mean, I have a hard time not saying what I think is the truth. So for them to call me a fibber and shame me for it really confused me till I was adult. Like I thought, what was I fibbing about? And I think probably when I look back, it was probably I was seeing things, feeling things, hearing things, and they just didn't know what to do with it. And so I guess the advice I would give to anyone dealing with children is to have more curiosity and not shame them for whatever's going on for them, to really wonder about, oh, well, that's interesting. You know, tell me more, you know, and that it's a gift. It's not a curse. It's not lying. It's not any of those sorts of things. Kids should not be shamed. Obviously, I mean, I think that should be obvious. They should not be shamed. And to have some sense of curiosity and to, you know, I remember from a very young age, I had real sensitivity to sound. Like I couldn't handle the sounds. And my mother had a hearing problem. There was a TV in every room in my house growing up, and I couldn't handle the chaos. And I couldn't sleep at night because she had the TV on, and I could hear it from across the house, two stories up. I could still hear it. And she didn't believe me. I could tell her word for word what was being said. So just to take seriously that these children have sensitivities. They have, you know, their senses are awakened in a different way than others. And, you know, to just be more spacious around what they're dealing with. I mean, they're on overload. This planet is overloaded, emotions, sounds, you know, and to take these children and what they're sensitive to seriously. So that's, to have more compassion for what they're dealing with, and that they have had an experience, extraordinary experience of being in a setting that's so loving. So, I mean, it's hard to even fathom where they've been. And to come back to the harshness at times, the harshness of the world here is so, I mean, that to me is the biggest trauma, not the accidents or whatever. It's a trauma of being back in a realm where people are so unconscious. They hurt each other so readily. And that's what's traumatic. And that the child feels lonely to go back to where that original space of love was, because that love is not so not present here in the same way. So I think that's what I would, if I could advise anyone, to just be tender with these children that have had these experiences.
Yeah, and not only the children, I mean, as an adult with NDE and NDE experiencers also, that's also their complaint as well. So because they feel most of the time the other side and the other world more real than that this world that we are living in it. And just, I mean, being connected, there's also research and a study from University of Virginia that the children before the age of four are more connected to the other side. So either if they have the NDEs or even if they don't have the NDEs, and the NDEs especially are more sensitive and perceptional to the other side and what they are feeling and hearing, as you mentioned, that is, and the truth of the universe and the reality that they feel.
One of the things that this woman named P.M.H. Atwater, who wrote this book called Forever Angels that I just started reading, she talks about adult experiences of NDEs work on integrating their experiences. So they've had a before and an after, whereas children of NDE experiences compensate. There's a compensatory, there's a different, it's a different, they don't have anything to integrate because they don't have, as you said, they don't have a lot of before. So, so they're compensating constantly. Like it's a whole different mechanism. Anyway, I don't really, since I haven't had a adult NDE, I don't know what the difference is, but I can say that I can see the truth of that, that there's a lot of, there's a lot of shock. It's just, you don't know, sort of like landing on a planet that is so foreign on some level and also feels dangerous. Whereas if adults who experiences have learned how to already cope with that, and then they have an experience of NDE, then they integrate it, and it's a different, it's a, I guess, a different experience, as she describes it.
A different kind of experience and different path in coping mechanism as well, because I mean, they have the opportunity of educating themselves. I mean, for me as a physician also, I wasn't able to talk about it, not being shamed about it, but just being in a medical community and the gap of a spirituality in medical community. I wasn't sure how it's being received, you know, with medical professionals. But luckily these days, I mean, there's so much education about the NDEs and all the spiritual transformational experiences. And for the physicians and healthcare professionals, and they are more aware of this phenomena. While, I mean, for me, even I had this experience in 2008, so there wasn't that much, you know, in the literature of the medicine, actually, or journals of the medicine about that. Talking about all of these experiences, how do you define the spirituality?
Yeah, well, I think what you brought up about the medical community and, you know, Harvard, I mean, where I trained, and other places like Harvard, is, you know, we're in the business, and scientists are in the business basically of dealing with what our five senses can handle. And also, you know, now we have instruments that can measure infrared, you know, light and other things that our senses can't discern. But to me, there are realms that cannot be discerned, that science is not caught up with yet. So, you know, there's all sorts of dimensions and quantum dimensions and experiences that our senses cannot capture, our five senses. I mean, we have many senses, but anyway, these five senses, physical senses. So to me, you know, spirituality is really about the energies that are not detectable yet by our, you know, not that our five senses can't detect. We don't have scientific measure instruments sometimes that can detect them. And they're, you know, dimensions that can't be detected. And so these are the experiences that we call mysticism and that are spiritual in nature. And spirituality means to me also that there are non-physical beings, that there are other beings other than human beings, and that they're in, you know, that they cannot be seen again with our five senses, or heard, or, you know, I can hear certain things. I can, you know, we can, anyway, there's, I don't know if that's a clear enough definition, but to me there, it's just the world of the unseen and non-ordinary reality, that to me is spiritual and mystical.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And since we talk about the trauma and the healing of the trauma, I think this is a really good space just to bring this together. So, and ask you that, I mean, do you believe that a spirituality can be a healing tools for trauma?
I think it's necessary, actually. I mean, in fact, I was supposed to write a book. Harvard University Press wanted to first publish my book, a book based on my dissertation. And part of where I hit a wall is that this was now over 10 years ago. I hit a wall because I knew that spirituality had a key piece in this, and I didn't know how to write about it at the time. And I just didn't know how to write about it for an academic press, to tell you the truth. It's always been the problem. And anyway, so yes, spirituality, I think it's not absolutely necessary, and people talk around it, but I think it's a really critical component to understand trauma and also to heal trauma.
Yeah, and coaching peers model, actually a spiritual intelligence and a spirituality is on the top of our pyramid model, that without spiritual intelligence and spirituality, we are not a completed, you know, connected whole of our whole self. And as your practice, you know, and research in shamanism also is just that it's a religious practice that involves a practitioner interacting with the spiritual world and the energy that they bring for the healing. Yeah,
Yes.
before we finished, I just wanted to ask you about your book entitled With the Generative Cultural Renewal, and what is a generative society or organization to you, and in regard to trauma footprint, and can we reduce it, and that includes the microaggressions too.
I developed the idea of what generativity means in a chapter, and then I talk about what renewal, cultural renewal means, and what makes it generative, because not all cultural renewal is generative, meaning that many societies, when they've experienced traumas, attempt to heal their traumas by renewing themselves. So, for example, you know, an iconic example is Nazi Germany, where after World War I, you know, Hitler and people like Hitler arose to try to renew their culture, you know, by, you know, in various ways, but it was not generative. It was actually traumatizing in turn. You know, we can look at the Yugoslavian society, the Serbs trying to renew their culture, and again, causing a lot of damage and genocide through their attempts at cultural renewal. And, you know, we can look at our even home country of Iran and think of it as attempting to renew its culture, Islamic culture, and look at what it's done. And ISIS is another example. I mean, there's lots of examples of how peoples have tried to renew themselves culturally, but they end up causing more damage and trauma because they haven't healed their traumas. And the renewal is actually not a renewal. It's actually a trauma response. So I talk about generative cultural renewal. So there's a whole section on what generativity means, what generative cultural renewal means, and the framework for how do you do it, whether it's in an organization or in a culture.
Wonderful. And thank you for the food for thought, Suzanne, and making us curious enough, you know, as I mentioned, to come back for the part two and follow up our
Thank you.
conversations. And before we leave, and let us know how our audience can know and more about what you have done and what you are doing, except that they can, I mean, hear this conversation on our YouTube and Spotify podcast channel. And what is your website and where they can find your articles, which of course we are going to add it into our resource page.
Oh, great. Well, thank you for doing that. Well, my website is just simply my name, www.susanabadian.com. So it's Sousan Abadian.com. And if you look up my name in Harvard Magazine, there's an article about my earlier work with tribal communities. And of course, my book is there. And if you want to contact me, I give talks and workshops and all sorts of things, do trainings. There's a contact information on my website as well. Or you can just write me contact@susanabadian.com. That's the other way to contact me. And thank you so much for having me on your wonderful, on this show. And I really appreciate the questions you've asked me.
Thank you so much for being here today, Suzanne, and your contribution, you know, to our nonprofit. And I hope that you enjoy the conversation as we did and our listener will do. Have a
Thank
wonderful
you.
Day.
You too. Thank you so much.
Goodbye to our listeners, and remember, one podcast at a time. Thank you for being with us for another one. You can visit our website at myconscious.org to learn more about us, or write to us at coach@myconscious.org. And please stay connected by following us on our social media platforms, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, not to miss our upcoming episodes and events. Love and light from all of us to you. Make it a great day, everyone.